This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Orange County School Board meeting Tuesday ended with no decision on how to reopen in fall. Meanwhile, other school districts have rolled out reopening plans, giving parents a choice of classroom learning or virtual school. We're discussing on Intersection today the challenge of reopening in Orange County and other school districts as coronavirus cases continue to surge and what that means for public health and the economy. Joining us today, 90.7's Amy Green, who's covering the story. Amy, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also joined by paediatrician Dr. Candace Jones. Dr. Jones, thank you as well.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Kenneth Alexander, he is the Chief of Division of Infectious Disease at Nemours Children's Hospital. Dr. Alexander, thank you too.
Pleasure being with you.
We want to hear from you as well. Reach out to us on Twitter with your comments and questions. We're at WMFE Orlando. Amy, let me start with you. You've been following this story closely. First of all, just remind us what that executive order from Education Secretary Richard Corcoran, Commissioner rather, Richard Corcoran, calls for.
That's right. Well, he released an emergency order last week requiring brick-and-mortar schools to reopen 5 days a week and offer a full slate of services for all students. The order leaves it to local school districts to make decisions about how to do this, and it also is contingent on any advisory from the State Department of Health or local health officials about, you know, whether it would be unsafe to do that. And so here in Central Florida, just for example, in Orange County, the school board met for a nearly 10-hour meeting on this Tuesday evening. Mm-hmm. And Teresa Jacobs made the point that, just for example, in Orange County, we don't have any advisory from local health officials that opening brick-and-mortar schools 5 days a week is unsafe. And
right.
And so that's what they're looking at doing.
Right. And so Teresa Jacobs, chair of the Orange County School Board, obviously kind of laying out some of the concerns there. What about some of the other counties in Central Florida? What are we hearing from them?
Well, all counties are grappling with this in similar ways. Most counties are presenting parents with at least two options, one being the face-to-face option, and then the other option being a virtual learning or a distance learning situation, and a lot of those details are still being worked out as we speak. Another option for parents is a local virtual school. Most counties offer a virtual school that is a franchise of the Florida Virtual School.
Right. So that meeting that you referred to, that you are tuning into, a pretty long meeting that comes on the heels of a very long meeting last week as well. Let's hear a little bit of the public comment from the Orange County School Board meeting on Tuesday.
The truth lies in a very gray middle ground. There are legitimate issues on both sides of this challenge. I appreciate where people are coming from when it comes to this deeply emotional fire they have. But teachers in large are not trained to teach virtually. We learned that last semester.
We as teachers could do almost anything. You know, we sacrifice so much, but we cannot sacrifice the health and wellness of ourselves. You know, the new plan has a lot of options for parents and students. It does not have any for educators. Our ability to stay home is based off of if children are going to stay home. I am fearful.
I know that my position makes it disproportionately difficult for me to stay home with my children, and that lots of parents with special needs children will struggle to be able to accommodate for them. Listening to the concerns of teachers, many of whom express that they themselves have health concerns, really has opened my eyes to the fact that opening now is just not advisable.
All right, so you heard there from Michael Friedman, Ashley Modesto, and Christina Broussard. They were speaking at the Orange County School Board meeting's public comments section on Tuesday. Amy, we're going to talk a little bit about how that meeting went, but first I want to bring Dr. Candace Jones into this conversation. Dr. Jones, I know you've got to get back to seeing patients, so appreciate you stepping in here. But what kind of concerns are you hearing from parents as they contemplate schools reopening in fall?
I am hearing things all over the spectrum. And it really echoes some of the public comments that we just heard. Some parents did well. Some kids did very well. Some families did very well. Their children maintained their A average. They were structured. They had routine. They didn't have a lot of problems with the distant learning. They had internet. They had a laptop. They had the resources they needed to do the distant learning, and their family adjusted well. On the other hand, I have children who, whether they have ADHD or a learning disability or some type of special need, or a parent who is just not equipped to teach their child, they struggled with getting their child to do their work or even helping their child learn. And so those parents are telling me now that they think their kids are better served in school, and they plan to put them in school, but they are aware of the risk of COVID, and so they're in a tough place. And then the other parents I mentioned are keeping their children home. So even parents have different opinions when it comes to this debate of kids being in school or not right now with COVID, with us being in a COVID hotspot.
Right, and you mentioned the kind of challenges of online learning. That's something a lot of parents have wrestled with as they juggle work and homeschooling. But what about the, you know, the potential downside of not having your kids in a physical classroom setting? Just setting aside the health risks of going back to school and potentially being exposed to COVID. But what about that sort of maybe emotional, you know, kind of challenge there might be of not being in a classroom setting, and some of the sort of learning slippage that we might see as well?
Right. We know that kids learn beyond academics in school. They learn social and emotional skills. Some kids rely on school for healthy meals, exercise, mental health support, and other services that they can't get from online learning. So that definitely is a concern, and that's one of the reasons. And then even some of our special education children and children who are subject to those inequities with lunch and internet and health care and all of that stuff. So that's one of the reasons why pediatricians, the American Academy of Pediatrics, supported having a goal of trying to get kids back into school. And so that is truly a concern. And I think all parents, even myself being a parent, share that concern. But then the question is, how are you going to keep my kids safe? And am I willing to risk them getting COVID and being one of the kids who has a poor outcome from it? That's the problem we're facing.
Mm-hmm. Just before we have to let you go, Dr. Jones, what's your take on masks? Because that can be a bit of an emotional subject too, right? We've seen lots of back and forth from people who say they believe they are good and they should work, or they shouldn't have to have their sort of rights infringed. Where do you stand on that?
I think it's a time to talk about we and not me. I think this is about public health. We know what works. We saw that when we stayed at home and we distanced and we wore our masks. We see the evidence to reduce the spread of this infection by doing those things, those safety measures. And so when individuals make this about their rights and make this political, I think that's irresponsible and I think it's selfish. This is about we coming together and supporting public health efforts so that we can all get through this together. And that's where I stand.
Well, Dr. Candace Jones, pediatrician who practices in the Pine Hills community of Orlando, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Amy, I want to come back to you. Just thinking back to that meeting on Tuesday, some comments there, and some of them sort of getting quite emotional too. Just give us a sense of how that meeting felt for you sort of listening in on it.
Absolutely. Well, this meeting, as I mentioned, it went on for almost 10 hours, and it was I would say 5 to 6 hours of public comment, overwhelmingly against opening brick and mortar schools. A lot of very emotional public comment from teachers who, as you heard in the clip there, are very fearful.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Kenneth Alexander, Chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Nemours Children's Hospital, I want to bring you into this conversation. Now, you've been advising school districts on reopening. Who are you working with and what are you telling them?
So we've been working mostly with Osceola schools and with Polk County schools. And I think there's a couple of important points that we do have to keep in mind. And I think the districts recognize this. First of all, safety is the most important consideration. And this is not just safety of the children, but in fact, you know, one of the things that we've learned with this pandemic is that by and large, children do very well. children represent really only a minority of hospitalized cases. So children do well. I'm much more concerned about the health and safety of teachers and staff. So as we make our plans, we have to worry mostly about the safety of teachers and staff. And we're juxtaposing that against the idea that school is important. And certainly Dr. Jones mentioned, school is not just a place for education. It's socialization. It's safety. It allows parents to work and provide for their families. And even, you know, things like detection of child abuse and things that we've seen blossom during this pandemic. So what we've asked the schools to do or advise they do is to provide a spectrum of options. And that way, you know, for parents that can educate their children at home, reduce the burden on the school, that's the safe thing to do. By reducing the number of students in the schools, we can protect the teachers as well. So I think the most important thing is to provide options for teachers and for educators.
Got a question coming in here over Twitter. Haley Sparks Pereira writes, my son had mesoblastic nephroma and now has only one kidney. Is he at increased risk? And there's a second part to that question too. He's on spectrum with ADHD and didn't do well with virtual school. We are struggling with this decision. Haley, thanks so much for writing in. And I think that kind of really illustrates some of the challenges that people are wrestling with. Dr. Alexander, what would you say? Is that something that you're hearing a lot of too, that parents are kind of trying to really weigh the health and kind of safety risks with this kind of notion of their kids not doing so well in the virtual school environment?
Absolutely. And in fact, there's really two considerations here. As far as the child themselves, it's actually rather peculiar that while we think of many infectious diseases being more severe in immunocompromised children, in fact, with COVID-19, that's not so clear. So I could not look the caller in the eye and say that because of what their child has undergone, that that child is at greater risk of severe disease. I don't think anybody knows for sure. Mm-hmm. The flip side, though, is this. We are a society where many of us live in multi-generational families, especially as I talked with the school boards in Polk County and Osceola County. And a consideration would be that the parents would do just fine if they got COVID-19, but the elderly grandmother or uncle that they're caring for may not. And so that's part of the consideration that families have to put in.
Right. And I think that's a kind of thing that people are struggling with right now, right? Whether to completely isolate elderly family members and, you know, to prevent them from seeing the younger members of the family just to keep them safe, right? But that's a real struggle. That's kind of an emotional challenge that a lot of families are going through.
Absolutely. This is nobody's idea of fun. And in fact, what we've got to balance, and I think this is each family's individual decision, is the proven benefits of having your kid at school in some form versus the risk of infection. I mean, if we wanted to reduce the risk of infection to zero, we'd just stick our kids in the sock drawer and wouldn't let them out of the house. But we wouldn't go out of the house either because as parents we might get infected. That doesn't benefit our kids. Nor can we go to the other extreme and say, well, you know, there's nothing happening here. We just go on life business as usual. So what we've got to do, and this is the challenge that each school board has, is finding the points in the middle where parents are going to feel the safest. But realizing that, like every other calculation we make in life, there are risks, there are benefits, nothing is risk-free, and nothing is benefit-free.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking about the plan to reopen schools as coronavirus cases continue to surge statewide. With us on the program, Dr. Kenneth Alexander, Chief of Division of Infectious Disease at Nemours Children's Hospital, and 90.7's Amy Green. Dr. Alexander and Amy, please stay with us. We'll be right back after this. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We're discussing the challenge of reopening in Orange County and in other school districts across the state of Florida as coronavirus cases continue to surge, what that means for public health and the economy. We'd like to hear from you if you're a parent and concerned about sending your kids back to school. You can tweet us at WMFE Orlando. With us on the show, 90.7's Amy Green, who's covering the story, and Dr. Kenneth Alexander, Chief of Division of Infectious Disease at Nemours Children's Hospital. That's Twitter account again, at WMFE Orlando. Your questions and comments, we'll take them there. Amy, what's the Orange County School Board saying about the reopening plan? And, you know, what's stopping them from just not reopening at all if cases are still as bad in August as they are now?
Yeah, well, in Orange County, and full disclosure, I myself am an Orange County parent. In Orange County, parents are being presented with three options. One is the face-to-face option. The second is Orange County Virtual School, which is fully accredited and predates the pandemic. And then the third option is one called Launch Ed at Home, which is the one that the district especially is kind of touting or recommending to parents. And it allows children to stay enrolled at their same schools. Children will be assigned to a teacher in a classroom, but they will be doing lessons at home. This option also allows children to combine face-to-face and at-home learning according to parents' preferences. Teresa Jacobs is chairwoman of the Orange County School Board, and she was very clear Tuesday evening when she said that the emergency order that we have received from the state, that funding is based on schools reopening. And so the point she made during this very emotional school board meeting Tuesday evening was that she has very serious concerns, and other school board members voiced very serious concerns about reopening schools as we're seeing the coronavirus pandemic surge in Florida. However, the funding is based on schools reopening, and she fears that keeping schools closed would jeopardize that funding. And so teachers who are fearful about coming back to school would be faced with potentially losing their jobs, undergoing a layoff. And so Chairwoman Teresa Jacobs and the other school board members characterize this as a very obviously difficult situation. They talked very late into the evening about this and basically began experiencing some technical problems. And so they decided to table the discussion and will come back and pick it up again tomorrow morning at 9 a.m.
Right. So, quite a lot to unpack there. And I guess it's not entirely clear what the end result will be. But we've seen sort of what some school districts are doing, a combination of virtual school, in-person learning. Dr. Alexander, in Osceola County specifically, what have they kind of come up with, and how does that sort of fit into the advice that you've been giving them?
Their plan is very much the same, that they're offering the brick-and-mortar school for children that fits best for. And as you can imagine, that's perhaps even a different group of kids that are on the other extreme of complete virtual school. And then, as you mentioned, there's sort of an at-home version that's still run by the bell at school. So there's three choices. And I think the other part of it is that, as I understand their planning, you're not committed to one single plan. That as there is change in the virus, as there's change in what happens in the schools, parents are being afforded a degree of flexibility.
Mm-hmm. We've got a question coming in here. This is via Facebook, and Michelle Paisley Park. There's actually quite a bunch of questions here. I think this may be some questions that have been circulating. But if a teacher tests positive for COVID-19, are they required to quarantine for 2 to 3 weeks? Is their sick leave covered and paid? Dr. Alexander, I don't know you can answer that specifically, but I mean, are those some of the questions that school districts have been asking you, like how to navigate what happens if a staff member or staff members get sick?
So this is an important question, and it's important not only in the schools, but this has been an important consideration as we've tried to keep our hospitals up and running. Because as you can imagine, exposure and infection occurs in hospital employees, doctors and nurses and therapists, just the way it does in school teachers. And so we have followed the recommendations from the CDC so that if an employee tests positive, they are kept home for 10 days or for 3 days past complete resolution of symptoms, whichever is longer. And by doing that, this ensures that people have cleared their infection. Now, tied in with this is testing. And one of the great challenges we have, especially in Central Florida, is a lack of testing availability. And testing has limited availability for adults, and there's really almost no testing availability for children.
Right. Amy Green, was there any discussion about that in the Orange County School Board meeting, like whether the school district in Orange County at least can sort of pay for testing and the cost of that rolling forward?
That's been a very big question on the minds of a lot of parents, and I think that is one of the things that the school board will take up tomorrow morning. Tuesday's meeting primarily was public comment, and by the time the school board began discussing the issues, they began experiencing some technical problems, and they tabled the discussion and decided to come back on Friday and talk about it some more. And so I expect we'll get some more details tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. But Matthew, to Amy's point, even if the school board were able to pay for testing, it's not available. You can't buy it.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, some organizations have been able to acquire tests, right? I mean, we have the MLS and the NBA kind of on our doorstep at ESPN Wide World of Sports Complex, and they're being tested, right? So, but to your point, yes, testing availabilities can be a challenge. Amy, just coming back to that idea of online learning, we heard a little bit of that before the break. One of the people who was commenting publicly was saying, look, it hasn't really been perfect, right? It hasn't worked that well. Teachers had to kind of work pretty hard to get up to speed on online learning and students too. Amy, what kind of shape is the Orange County School District in now when it comes to online learning? Do you get the sense that they feel like they're better prepared for that coming up to this semester?
Yeah, well, I think, again, we'll get some more details on those issues tomorrow. But we are learning that with Launch Ed at home, parents will have the option of combining face-to-face and at-home learning, which we didn't have in the spring. And then one of the school board members proposed a few ideas. One idea she had for reopening schools was to reopen schools as what she called learning labs. That would be for children of parents who absolutely have to send their kids to school, whether because they're essential workers or, you know, whatever the situation is. And these schools would be staffed by volunteer teachers rather than asking teachers to do what they're not comfortable doing. Mm-hmm. But at this point, a lot of these things are hypothetical, and it's a stressful situation for parents and for teachers and for everyone, because as we know, the school year is very fast approaching, and a lot of these details still need to be worked out. A lot of the school districts in Central Florida are talking about pushing back the start of school. In Orange County, they talked Tuesday about pushing it back from August 10th to as far as August 31st. Mm-hmm. And we'll just have to wait and see what's decided on.
What about plans for sanitizing classrooms and keeping them safe? What is the school district talking about there, Amy?
Again, in Orange County, just for example, we're being told that hand washing would be a scheduled part of the day, face masks would be required, and social distancing would be implemented where feasible, although the district is acknowledging that in many instances, social distancing will not be possible. In other counties, districts are still discussing whether they will actually require face masks.
Hmm. Dr. Kenneth Alexander, let me just read a comment from a teacher, Elizabeth Lamachia. She sent us a video of her spacing out her desk 6 feet in a portable classroom. She'll have to have about eight students. She'll be able to have about eight students, she said, and, quote, this is going to be a challenge I'm up for, but a challenge nonetheless. Dr. Alexander, what about spacing in classrooms? How effective is it going to be to keep kids, you know, spaced apart, given the fact that they're all going to be in a room for like 40 minutes at a time?
If we can do it, spacing works. I think there's now a good solid body of data that social distancing and masks used in combination works. Now, if we go to the healthcare setting, because we don't have a lot of experience yet, a lot of data from schools, but if we look at what happens in a children's hospital, what we've learned is that 6 feet apart is great. If you have to get within 6 feet of one another, this is where the mask makes a huge difference. So masking is going to be absolutely critical. And then you mentioned sort of closed spaces, ventilation, and whenever possible, being outside. If classes, activities can be done outside is certainly the safest place for a class to be.
Right. That's going to be tricky in the heat of summer, though, isn't it, in Florida?
Indeed.
Brandon writes in on Twitter, "My son is too young for school, but I'm still concerned about his development. We've only got one friend whom we trust to be safe, and luckily her daughter is our son's age, but I'm worried he isn't getting enough social interaction." Dr. Alexander, what about that? I mean, that's a challenge that parents are wrestling with no matter how old their kids are, right? Whether their kids are kind of getting socialized enough.
This is a huge concern among parents. And, you know, let's be candid. We are social creatures, and our children are the most social among us. That being said, you know, we as a people have come through world wars. We've come through people in bomb shelters. There are children growing up in places that make the adversity that we are facing seem like nothing. So while I agree with the concern for children and our desire to optimize things, do have faith in a parent, as a parent, in the resilience of children. Children will do well despite all this. And in fact, for many children, while we think of educating them at home as a challenge, I'll bet you that many children will look back at this and say, you know, I had more time with mom and dad that year than just about any time in my life, and it was wonderful.
Right. It can be a bit stressful, though, if you're working at home and you're trying to juggle childcare, too. I mean, that does not necessarily make for great kind of one-on-one time with your kids.
I agree totally. And as my wife says, we're not working at home. We're at home trying to work.
Yeah. Just back to the idea of how this disease affects children. Do we really have enough information about that? Because, you know, I guess a lot of the cases have been, or the more serious cases have been in the more elderly patients or the older patients. We are seeing that median age of people with COVID-19 coming down. But what do we really know about how the disease can affect kids?
Well, this is an excellent question, and of course, it's a new disease, so we're still learning. But in the short term, you figure that, you know, this disease has been with us now for about 6 months, that what we're seeing is the vast majority of kids that get this disease do just fine and seem to have no long-term repercussions. There are children who have mild illness who may have some pulmonary function or lung abnormalities that can be something that will last for a period of time, but this is something that happens with even things like influenza. Mm-hmm. There are the rare cases, and that's typically kids with risk factors, probably developmental problems, morbid obesity. Those are the kids that end up in the hospital and have lung problems. And finally, there's this very rare group of this multi-system inflammatory syndrome. This is rare, rare, rare. It gets a lot of attention in the press and so on, mm-hmm. but it's very rare. In all of Florida, I think there's only been two or three cases. So that's something we're still learning about.
Right. Kawasaki syndrome, is that there was a rash of cases, so to speak, in the New York area a couple months ago?
Very good. It's very similar to Kawasaki syndrome, but in fact probably 10 times more rare.
Well, that's interesting. And just in the last few seconds we have here, Dr. Alexander, I mean, are you seeing a surge in cases at all at Nemours, or is it fairly steady?
So we've got, we've probably had now a total of about 6 inpatients, almost all of them. I think we've got 2 in the hospital right now. For most of them, they've done very well. It's been very mild, and COVID has been an incidental finding. So the children have done very well.
We've been speaking with Dr. Kenneth Alexander. He is Chief of the Division of Infectious Disease at Nemours Children's Hospital. Dr. Alexander, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
And we're also speaking with 90.7's Amy Green, who's following the story as it unfolds. Thanks so much, Amy.
It's nice to talk with you.
Still to come, as the pandemic intensifies, so does the need for food banks. We'll talk to FarmShare about a food distribution event in Orlando this weekend. Stay with us, we'll be back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. As the coronavirus pandemic intensifies, so does the need for food banks. FarmShare's Matthew Galen says the North Florida warehouse he works out of has increased the amount of food it's handing out by 500% in the last few months. This weekend, FarmShare will hold a drive-through distribution event in Orlando. I spoke with Matthew Galen, who's the facilities manager of FarmShare of Northeast Florida, and Yvette Shelton Edmonds, manager of the Holden Heights Community Center, about why events like these are being held more frequently. Yvette, I want to start with you. You're hosting an event this weekend distributing food. Just explain a little bit about what you're going to be doing on Saturday.
We will be having a drive-through food distribution at the Holden Heights Community Center. The purpose of the drive-through food distribution is to help families in need in the community and surrounding areas as they are struggling during this difficult time with COVID-19.
What's your sense of what the need is?
The need is tremendous. We typically do food distributions on a regular basis, and with COVID-19, we have a lot of people who work in the hotel industry and in the entertainment and amusement parks, and they're no longer working. Therefore, they can't meet their they can't pay their bills or meet their needs and need assistance with food.
And what kind of things do they need? I mean, is it just food, or are they looking for other staples as well?
They are also looking for other staples. They're in need of personal hygiene products, diapers, baby wipes, everything that you can think of that we use for our daily needs, people are in need of now.
Matthew Galen, if I could bring you into this conversation, explain a little bit about what FarmShare does. You're throughout the state of Florida, right?
We are a large nonprofit food distribution center. And we provide food to pantries and agencies throughout the state. One of the big differences between us and the other distribution centers is we don't charge our agencies anything. We do everything through our government contract and through private donors. And we have always done events. That's what separates us as well from the other providers, but we started the drive-through event back at the beginning of March. The very first one I did back then, it was over 600 cars, and basically it's a no-contact, safe way to provide these staples that people need without any kind of interaction. It's basically any kind of communication is done with hand signals and stuff like that.
Is this something new? I mean, have you had to learn how to do this without contact, and has that been a bit of a learning curve?
It has, but a lot of the we were very much ahead of the curve because we had already done events, and so our events before, people would just park and walk up. Basically, This model that we use now was based off of the California National Guard. And we had a conference call with the state of Florida and the FDACS department. And we just went over a plan of action of a way that we could get this food to the people without any contact or exposing any of the volunteers.
When you hold these events, do you typically have, like, what's the kind of response you get? Do you find that you get more people showing up? Are you able to kind of gauge how much food you're going to need and get that pretty well figured out?
Yeah, it's virtually impossible for us to determine the amount that are going to actually show up. We do our best to get the word out and spread it through Facebook and the agency, and then we have flyers that go around. But with the increase that we've seen, we went from being a packing house that sends out about close to 1 million pounds a month to in June, we sent out over 5 million pounds. So the increase is huge. And with the unemployment $600 bonus about to end at the end of this month, people are needing to rechannel those funds. And obviously they're going to lose them unless something happens between now and then. And then the demand's just going to skyrocket. I mean, we constantly get people asking us for more than food. And so we're at the mercy of our donors to help us acquire product like that.
Just so I'm clear on the numbers, that's 5 million pounds of food just for the state of Florida?
That's 5 million pounds of food for my packing house in Northeast Florida.
Okay.
So just out of, we're based out of Jacksonville, and we cover 11 counties, and then we go further. We go into Orlando, obviously, and we go down to Pasco County. When we do stuff like that, we're not allowed to take government food with us because we don't have a contract for that area. We take food that is provided to us through private donors.
But you're saying it's basically a fivefold increase that you've seen?
Yeah, 500%. That's a 500% increase over last year. I started out in March. It was a 200% increase. And, I mean, it's just kept growing and growing, so...
And it sounds like with some benefits ending, at least that we know of, that need is going to even increase further.
Yeah, I mean, you have that, and then you have us being, the hotspot of the resurgence right now is kind of, that's going to have a large impact on the needs. And I know that the Secretary Perdue of USDA, he's been putting together some programs that have been pretty phenomenal as far as getting us more food and getting more food to the people. So that's made it a little bit easier for us to help support groups.
Mm-hmm. Yvette Shelton-Nibbins, back to you. What can you tell us about the families that you're going to be helping this weekend? Who are you serving?
We will be serving single individuals, families with children, senior citizens, basically from all walks, just everyone in need, seniors, families, single individuals.
And we spoke a little bit before we started recording, and you were telling me that you're really seeing a surge in demand for the kind of services that you provide, Yvette, with senior citizens. Just talk a little bit about that if you could.
Yes. The typical person would think that the seniors may not be affected because they typically do not work. And what we're finding is that senior citizens that are on Social Security have an increased need for supplies and food. And that's because they were depending on relatives and family members to provide support. And those relatives can no longer provide that support. So we're seeing a tremendous amount of seniors in need of services.
Mm-hmm. How far afield do the folks come from? Are they all in the Holden Heights area, or are you getting people from across Orange County and even outside of the county as well?
We're getting people from across Orange County, and we even get a lot of people from Osceola County that come in for services as well, looking for food and supplies.
And what does that tell you just about the kind of economic situation we're in, not just in Orange County, but here in Central Florida?
That there's a great need, that people are hurting. And that's what we hear when they come in to see us face to face. They're pretty hopeless by now and in need of help.
Just getting some basic supplies, though, what does that do for somebody's sense of well-being? I mean, is it just as important to kind of get that helping hand, and even if it's just like a week's worth of groceries.
And that's it. I find that they have hope when they come in and they're able to get some supplies from our wonderful partners like FarmShare. It just gives them a sense of hope, and they can hold on just a little longer. And we're starting to, you know, we're typically we serve low-income populations that are in need, trying to break the cycle of poverty. But we are, due to COVID, we're servicing people who have never requested support or assistance from any organization before.
If I could add to that, I think that's one of the most important things Yvette was saying, word of mouth. And one of the hardest things for people to do, especially when they've been providing for themselves and their families their entire lives, and now they're experiencing something brand new, is a pride issue. And the fact that they've never had to go out and look for something like this. And it's really something that people have a hard time comprehending, that everything that we do is free. This is free food to the people. So we're trying to supply them with enough food to last them a week. And the thing about it is that food is a necessity, and it's almost a luxury at this point for some of these people. I mean, they're not used to getting the staple items like fresh fruit, pork loin, things like that, a gallon of milk, you know, things that they normally would have thought was just an everyday thing has become something that is a prized possession at this point. Mm-hmm.
If you're just joining me, my guests are Matthew Galen and Yvette Shelton Edmonds. We're talking about an upcoming food distribution event in Holden Heights in the Orlando area this weekend. Matthew, back to the FarmShare, your organization, did it start out as like surplus food from farms, and has it kind of evolved into more of the kind of products that you'd find at any food pantry?
So we started up in Homestead, Florida, and the basis was that there was food at the farmer's market that was being discarded because it didn't meet certain grades, like grade levels through the USDA. So in 1991, we had our founder basically set up a system with the farmers that instead of they discard it, they would give it to her. And then she found channels to distribute. And so that's how we started out. And now we have branches in Quincy, we have a branch in Palatka, and we have the one in Jacksonville and one in Homestead. And obviously Homestead's a little bit more agricultural oriented, where Jacksonville is more of an industrial hub. So we do have a lot of food manufacturers that distribute out of this area. So we've broadened our horizons, and we're looking, you know, around to a lot more different sources and getting more of a variety of product, along with sticking with those main staples: the milk, the fresh fruit, the bread, protein. Those are all things that we will always do. People have to have it. And luckily, the USDA does a great job with providing us with those items through our contract. But also, you know, there's a lot of good-hearted people out there that donate and help us reach goals like the 5 million pounds last month. That was a huge thing for us. And we've exceeded $1 billion worth of food since we started in 1991.
So what can the folks who show up at the Holden Heights Distribution Center on Saturday expect? What are they going to get in their food parcel or their box?
It'll be the items like I was speaking about before, where it'll be, you know, the staples, and then we'll have treats for the kids. Obviously, we want them to, you know, there's nothing more satisfactory than seeing the kids be happy about getting a treat and just a smile on their face. You know, it's rough. You go to these drive-thrus, you see people, they're driving their 30-year-old cars that are barely running. And then right behind that, you might see a Mercedes-Benz. And it's just, right now, this pandemic, it doesn't know, wealth, color, age, anything. It's affecting all of us somehow or another. And it's just, people need help. And so we're here.
Yvette, you're going to be serving about 300 families, and you've also ramped up these food distribution events since the start of the year, right? You're now going to be trying to do at least one a month?
Yes, one a month.
Mm-hmm. And are you going to be partnering with FarmShare for all of them, or have you got some other partners to connect with as well?
Well, we definitely want to continue partnering with FarmShare, but we have other partners as well. And when you think about food, one of our people that received food stated to us that because we provided the food through our donors, they can actually buy medicine for themselves. And so it's not only just the food, it's giving that family that breather to where they can take those resources if they have it and use it for things like medication.
One other thing that I'm wondering if you're thinking about too, Yvette, is there's been this sort of looming threat of eviction hanging over a bunch of folks, and the moratorium on evictions was extended. So it was supposed to happen July 1st. It's been extended for another month. But is that something in the back of your mind too, as you think about the resources that people might need, beyond the end of this month and extra stress that might be putting on families?
Yes, we're definitely looking at that. And as a matter of fact, Orange County has online webinars regarding evictions to sort of help people to understand what they're able to do and what resources and support are out there for them. But yes, definitely. Mm-hmm.
And have you had a lot of people coming in and asking for help with that?
Yes, we have. And so we're referring them to 211 and 311 and have a list of housing resources. Housing has been something that is in need even prior to COVID. And so now it's even greater. And then, of course, there's the CARES funding where Orange County was able to assist with rent and mortgage assistance.
Matthew Galen, just kind of thinking about the volumes of food you're dealing with now in the last 4 months and what the challenge may be in the months ahead, are you worried at all about whether some of the folks that you partner with, the organizations that you partner with, to supply the raw materials that you then distribute, are you worried about that supply kind of drying up just because of the parlous state of the economy?
Right now, I can tell you that I have zero doubt that we're going to be able to supply what we need to the people. Like I was saying earlier, the USDA Secretary, Sonny Perdue, has come up with these projects, and one of them is the Farms to Family Box program, which is basically, it was the government put it out to bid for a whole bunch of distribution places to put together boxes of staple items, like one of them has chicken and cheese in it, another one has milk and apples and oranges and potatoes in it, and these boxes weigh about 16 to 20 pounds, and they are provided all across the country right now. And this program was just approved through August and is projected to go through December. So we have no fears of running out of product. There's a plethora. I think our biggest gap as far as getting the word out to the people that the food is there, it's available to them, and letting them know where they can go to get it. Because that, like I said before, a lot of people aren't used to living this lifestyle. And, it's going to get worse when the $600 goes away on that unemployment. And that's one thing that we're planning for right now.
Yvette Shelton Edmonds, before we go, just some details about where people can go to this event on Saturday if they need some help.
Yeah, at the Holden Heights Community Center, the address is 1201 20th Street. That's in Orlando. The zip is 32805. You want to enter on 20th Street. Just pull in the driveway. and the volunteers will be there to assist you. It is at 10 o'clock until while supplies last.
Yvette Shelton Edmonds is with Orange County. We've been talking about the food distribution event on Saturday in Holden Heights. Yvette, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Matthew Galen is with FarmShare. FarmShare is running the event. Thank you so much, Matthew.
Thank you. And just if I could throw a plug out there, please go to farmshare.org and donate if you can. We appreciate anything anyone can do. Just keep in mind $1 equals 10 pounds of food.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Production assistance for this week's show from Bill Johnson, Danielle Pryor, and Abe Abariah. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find previous episodes on our website, wmfe.org/intersection. When you donate right now to support WMFE, you're making all the news and information you rely on available for everyone free of charge. That service is as important today as ever, and it starts with your gift. Visit WMFE.org to make your contribution, and thanks. I'm Matthew Petty. Follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty. Thanks for listening.